Ahoy, and welcome aboard the battleship Pretension. I'm David Bax. Tyler Smith is still on his very long assignment since last summer. He's been on the show a few times and will continue to be. If you want to know what's going on with him, you can read updates at caringbridge.org/visit/Tyler and Jennifer Smith. There was a new one just this week. You can also make sure, if you haven't, and if you can, it would be really appreciated if you could donate to the GoFundMe, which you can find. There's a post pinned to the top of the homepage at battleshippretension.com that'll give you a link to that. Help Tyler and his family with the medical costs of being in one hospital or another for over half a year. It's not cheap. So please do that. Real quick, I want to tell you about tweakedaudio.com. Tweakedaudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great, they sound great. Tyler and I, well, not Tyler right now, I've confirmed he doesn't use them right now, but I use them each and every day of my life. Today, I was listening to the new Miley Cyrus album, Endless Summer Vacation. And she's got a lot of high profile collaborators like Sia and Brandi Carlile, and there's some big name producers on the album, and it seems like it's kind of picking back up on the like sort of mature pop road she was on before she detoured with the whatever the 2020 album was called. It was like her Pat Benatar album. This one doesn't have quite as many guitars, but I liked it, and it sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds that are available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code Pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code Pretension.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
We're back, and by we, I don't just mean the royal we. There is someone filling in for Tyler this week. Please welcome back to the show, actually, Battleship Pretension's resident musicologist, West Anthony. How are you, West?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Yeah, doing great.
Yeah, I'm coming through loud and clear and all that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think to ask before we started, but because I have a recording.
I'm sure I would have said something.
Yeah, I have a recording set up in my closet now, because I have a little walk-in closet, and I have all the stuff to do any recordings or anything of any kind just in here now, because the acoustics, I think, work out better this way.
It's very cool. Yeah. I should probably, I've been recording podcasts for, 15, 16 years. I should probably have something, some sort of professional setup, as opposed to just like sitting around my home office.
Well, I didn't say professional. Let's not get carried away.
But I actually do have a friend of Natalie's. Natalie's really, but I've known her for long enough that I consider her a friend, who is a professional, like voice artist. She does mostly commercials, but she's also done some like animated series and stuff. And even for like the biggest name, like chain, you know, stores and stuff that she's doing ads for, she's doing it at home in her closet. She's just built up like a little like pro studio in her closet. So I guess you really are just like the pros, West, is what I'm saying.
Well, maybe. I mean, I could put in some kind of like soundproofing stuff behind me and on the door over here. I could do that. I mean, I got a bunch of clothes hang up over here, and it's because it is a closet, so that's gonna absorb some sound. But other than that, I'd like to get a chair in here maybe one day.
You're just standing right now? Yeah, I can kind of.
Yeah, standing because the thing is, I mean, I have chairs, but I don't have a chair tall enough to accommodate where all this is set up. So, okay. But also I find that standing actually kind of helps me to focus my attention on what I'm doing. So, because that's I don't know if anybody cares about this, but just as a test on this, maybe I mentioned this to you, but I recorded a whole audiobook in here. just last year, late last year, somewhere around there. And and I don't know, I think it turned out okay. So it might be something that I will do more of in the future.
Can people find that anywhere?
I mean, you know, unless I send it to you, no, because the thing is, it's, well, you know, we're dealing with other people's copyrighted material, you know, and so it's like, I mean, I'm never going to sell it because that's, you know, going to lead to all kinds of problems. But in this case, you know, it's just, well, it's Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which has been out of print for decades. And so I figured that maybe some people I know might, you know, be curious about it because, you know, a lot of people have never even had the opportunity to read it.
Yeah, I've never read it, so yeah, I might reach out. so, to the listeners already have probably looked at the title of the episode and know what we're doing here. We you know, we generally save tributes to film related artists who have passed for our profile episodes, but a lot of people have died recently, so. When I realized we weren't going to be able to do an official like profile of the late great Angelo Badalamenti, I was like, well, we can't ignore his work. I got to turn to West. I've got to let West guide us, not through his entire filmography, because this, again, this is not a, a full on profile like we did with, Morricone, but this is West's sort of five favorite picks. Is that how you describe them?
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, might as well just warn everybody right now that it is going to be, you know, pretty David Lynch heavy. So I mean, he has worked with other people, to be sure.
You didn't pick a track from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation?
I did briefly consider, just I scanned through a couple of things because I do have a copy of something. They never really officially released it, but I got something. But I just thought, no, there's nothing really here that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
But he has worked with other people. And, you know, there is one example there. But that's kind of the thing is that most people, if they know him at all, they know him from his association with David Lynch because they've been linked very closely together for just decades.
Yeah. Do you, sorry to put you on the spot if you don't, but do you know how they came to work together?
My understanding was that, because he's worked as a musical director and, you know, he's, you know, written and arranged and produced, you know, some pop records. He produced in the height of Beatlemania and in the mid-60s, he produced a song. I believe it was called Santa Bring Me Ringo or Send Me Ringo or something like that. Okay. but the thing is that he was hired to work with, and now I'm blanking out on her name. She played Dorothy in the movie, Blue Velvet.
Isabella Rossellini.
Yes. Isabella. Thank you. He was hired to work with her for her singing. And in fact, you'll see that he plays the piano in the scenes in the slow club. That's him in there. But I guess he and Lynch got along during, you know, that period of rehearsals and working with Isabella. Because I know I'm pretty sure also that Isabella and David Lynch were together. They were a couple at the time. But as a result of that collaboration, Lynch invited Angelo to just compose the score for the movie.
And you know what? I mean, that's a great way in. Why don't we start by hearing some of that score? Let's hear it, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Thank you.
Yeah, I absolutely love that that prelude for the movie. It's like less than 2 minutes long, but it sets the mood in such a brilliant fashion. It's romantic, it's mysterious, it's got a little hint of menace to it. It's everything that you're going to have in the movie. Of course, you know, you'll have a lot of it and maybe more of it, and probably in ways that you weren't expecting because it's David Lynch. But it sets the tone so perfectly. It's just an absolutely just luscious piece of music. It's not a word I use to describe music often, but it really works on that one. And again, like just under 2 minutes and just boom, you're right in there. You're locked in. So. And then the next thing you hear is the song Blue Velvet, which it just doesn't measure up at all. I mean, it is a classic, but you can't hope to push that, the music for the prelude out of your mind. I can't anyway.
Yeah, it does. I think set the tone that we're going to be watching a. But first off, we're about to see what's a film noir, but it's set in the present day at the time, but it's also set in, a less explored part of the world that feels otherworldly, but also classical at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the fascinating things about what David Lynch does. He takes sort of, ordinary, close to mundane settings that we think we have a great deal of familiarity with. And then he just sort of dives in and finds just a really weird, uncanny angle.
Yeah. Do you want to move on to your second one then?
Yeah. Let's see. What was the second one?
The second one, I think chronologically should be from Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me.
That's right. And wow. That movie, that movie is it's a lot. It's a whole lot. And, I really, if I had my druthers, I probably would have just gone with the theme from Twin Peaks. But because technically that's from a TV show, I figured you wouldn't let that
and
go.
And also, this is when Angelo Badalamenti died, this is the song that I thought to tweet my like, RIP Angelo Badalamenti tweet. This is the song that I tweeted the YouTube link to. So let's hear it real quick.
Okay. And this, I mean, right off the bat, you see how versatile he is. When you listen to the prelude from Blue Velvet, and then you listen to this music, which is just like really just a grind in a way. And I remember how the music was used in the scene where, you know, you could barely hear what anybody was saying. They used, they put in subtitles the music was so loud, which is just probably also one of the most realistic portrayals of what it sounds like in a club.
Yeah, that's true.
That's always the thing that bugs me in those movies, where in other, where in a club where, you know, people are just like talking in a regular conversational tone of voice, and it's like you should be like screaming each other your heads off. But okay.
Yeah, I definitely remember thinking that, like, as much as I like Whit Stillman and I like Last Days of Disco, but there's a lot of just people just like sitting around this discotheque talking in that movie. But yeah, this song. I was going to say something else about that. I was going to say, I actually just had this thought, like, is there, you know how in like thrillers, when someone thinks they're being like watched or listened to, they like turn on the water or something, like, is there a movie where someone says, meet me at the club so they can talk illicit things with no one being able to hear? I feel like that's, that would be a good use of a real life thing. Anyway, I'm off track.
I don't think that has happened, though. That is a good idea.
This is, like I said, it was a song I thought to tweet a link to. It's the scene that I think of first when I think of this movie, because especially now that I have seen years ago, I saw this at the New Beverly, because this came out in 92.
Yeah.
That was the year I turned 10. I wouldn't have known of this movie, much less seen it in the theater. So I didn't discover this movie until the late 90s on VHS. And then eventually I bought the DVD when I was in college. But then, the New Beverly years ago did a Mulholland Drive Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me double feature. And now I've since watched it on Blu-ray as well. But I think seeing that scene, and hearing this song as loud as it's meant to be, where it just obliterates everything else, is so powerful, and probably why it left such a lasting mark on my psyche. But like you say, when I think of him generally, when I thought of him before this, I thought of Twin Peaks. I thought of it being lush. I thought of there being synths, that's a weird word to say, synths sometimes. But this is percussive. It's got rhythm and blues, but it's also like mean and dirty and
threatening. It sounds kind of skanky.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is one of the things that I like about it.
Yeah. Wow. At this rate, this is going to be a very short episode.
You know what, here's a quick bit of trivia though, before we move on to the next one. Firewalk with Me was the last movie that I saw at what was at the time the UA theater in North Hollywood. Remember the one on Victory? I mean, it changed hands and it became like something else. And then like towards the end, it was like, you know, $1.50 for whatever it was, you know, on Victory near Laurel Canyon.
Victory and Laurel. I can't picture it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't picture it because that wasn't the part of North Hollywood I lived in. Laurel and Victory.
Because I'm pretty sure Tyler went to that theater quite a bit.
And then it became, it was called the,
I think it was a Regal for a while.
Yeah, it was the Regency.
Regency.
Yeah, it was a Regency something. Yes, of course. I went there many times. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. That was it in the 90s. It was the United Artists Theater. That's what that chain. And yeah, that was the last movie that I saw there, because then I was spending almost all my time exclusively on the west side of the valley. And so, you know, I mean, there's plenty of theaters over there. But yeah, I've been to that theater quite a few times. That was also the theater where I saw my first midnight movie back in the... like late 70s, early 80s, somewhere around there. Saw the Rocky Horror Picture Show there.
Oh, you know, I've never actually seen that in a theater, which is probably the way to see it. But I do like Rocky Horror. I'm trying to think, the first midnight movie I ever went to, I think would have been, I know where it was. It was at the Tivoli in St. Louis, which is an old, like, you know, silent type of palace that's been, you know, hacked up into three different screens now. But the main screen is still pretty big. Or I don't know, I haven't been there in years. And I think, because I saw a lot of midnight movies there, I think the first one I ever saw might have been The Doom Generation, which would have been still fairly new at that time. Which, by the way, is being like remastered in 4K, The Doom Generation.
Oh, okay.
Tyler's not here to tell you how much he hates that movie, but I like The Doom Generation a lot.
I don't hate it, but it's not one of my favorites.
Yeah, I just like that era of Greg Araki, that very provocative era. And not that I don't like his, you know, Mysterious Skin is an amazing movie. Probably might be my favorite movie of 2005. But it does feel like Greg Araki, like, Tyler and I've always said that Mysterious Skin is Greg Araki saying, like, you know, I can do this if I want to, like, I can, you know, I can make like a serious drama of a movie. But anyway, we're way off track. Yeah, we mentioned, I made a reference to National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. He also did the third Nightmare on Elm Street, which I've never seen. But I feel like his sensibilities probably seem pretty suited to like a dreamy slasher movie.
Yeah, I can't remember which ones that I've seen. I know I've seen like at least two, but I can't remember which numbers they are.
Yeah, I've only seen the first one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we're taking a leap of I guess that was a 6-year leap, and now we're doing a 7-year leap. In between, he did The City of Lost Children. More Lynch with Lost Highway. He did Arlington Road, which I've never seen but heard good things about.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. But then the next one that you've picked is from 1999's The Straight Story. So let's hear that right now.
Thank you.
that movie was amazing to me because it just, I really didn't know he had it in him, I guess. David Lynch, that is, you know, it just, yeah. It felt like, wait, he's going to make a warm-hearted film that's suitable for the whole family with Walt Disney Pictures, and it's going to be rated G. This is going to be a train wreck of some kind. That's what I thought. I really did think that. And I guess I should have known better, but yeah, I mean, it not only was it not a train wreck, he basically jumped the train over the Snake River Canyon and stuck the landing. It was that good. But yeah, it's just, it is a thing of beauty. And the score really, you know, helps immensely. One of the things that when I was just rewatching it the other day, I was kind of struck by the way that, you know, because there are stretches where there's just no dialogue. There's just a guy just, you know, going down the road. And there is music, but I don't know, for some reason, I thought that there was, I had the feeling that like there was more music in there than there actually was. You know, I mean, like when you think about how Hitchcock used Bernard Herrmann in Vertigo, I mean, he's got that thing covered. there's music all over Vertigo. And, you know, Herrmann just basically, he saw an opportunity and he ran with it. But Angelo Badalamenti, what music is in there is choice, but it is used altogether very sparingly. It still, though, it sets the mood. And there's several different moods, you know, there's jaunty moods, there's very dramatic moods and, you know, wistful moods. There's just so much in there. There's so much emotion in that movie, and Badalamenti's score helps out a great deal because, you know, there's only so much you can do with visuals sometimes. And, but it's just, it really is just a thing of beauty. And that particular music that you just heard comes from sort of basically the penultimate scene when, you know, Alvin Strait is just about to reach the end of his journey. And I mean, I don't want to give anything away as far as the plot goes, but I mean, the whole point of the journey, you know, it is something that, you know, if you don't know it, as the character doesn't really know which way it's going to go. And the closer you get to it, obviously the more trepidation you're going to feel. So, but there's a lot of emotion and a lot of aching feelings, and the music just expresses that so brilliantly. I just absolutely love it.
Yeah. Also, go ahead.
I also remembered my favorite shot in the movie, which is where, you know, Alvin is basically just, you know, puttering down the road and the camera just sort of cranes up and then you get a nice look at, you know, there's some fluffy clouds in the sky. And that's where a scene is going to end. And they're going to fade away to something else. And instead, then the camera just comes back down again. And you see that he's only about 75 feet away from where he was the last time we saw him. And on the one hand, it's very useful in that it really gives you a clear idea of just how long this is going to take. But also, in terms of film grammar, it's a really funny joke. And that shot, I was instantly reminded of that shot when I saw the last shot of The Fablemans. And, you know, the fact that, you know, David Lynch was, you know, lurking about in that area, it certainly didn't hurt. But yeah, it was just like, it's really fun. Like that when you see these masters, just basically just sort of, you know, having a little fun with, you know, with what they're doing. They can just kind of cut loose and say, hey, here's some yucks for you, everybody.
Yeah, I listened to all these picks today when you sent them over. This was the one I was like, I got to watch this movie again because it's been so long since I've seen it. But I remember being blown away by it. It's definitely, given my age, it's the first Lynch film I would have seen in a theater. And it was because it was a Disney release. It was not at like an art house theater. It was at the AM or the was it an AMC? Yeah, it was an AMC. And I remember sitting there, I had gone to see it alone, and I remember sitting there in the theater and seeing like families come in and thinking like, how's this gonna go? Because I hadn't seen the movie yet. I didn't know. It was like, is this gonna be are these kids gonna be bored out of their minds? Are the parents gonna leave in a huff? But no, it's such a beautiful movie. Yeah, I need to watch it again. I immediately went to Just Watch right now to just see if it's streaming anywhere, and it occurred to me like, oh yeah, of course it's streaming. It's on Disney Plus. It's a Disney movie.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, you can watch it on Disney Plus, and I might do so again very soon because it's been a while. But yeah, I remember a lot about it. I don't remember the name of the girl in the movie. But I liked that section.
The runaway girl?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think she's a known actor, based on the IMDb here.
I didn't see anything when I was looking on Wikipedia. But now that since Disney has it, at least here in the States, now that makes me worry that we might not ever see like a Blu-ray release.
Right.
I mean, at least not in this country. We might, you know, it might be, might they might have it on an import somewhere else. But then again, you never know, because I mean, the Criterion Collection, I mean, they've done a lot of stuff with David Lynch, and they have done a couple of things with Disney. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if we can start a petition or a letter writing campaign or something, but I mean, it is a vague possibility. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily lose all hope. You know, what did they just do? WALL-E.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. Yeah, they did WALL-E.
But before that,
announced it. Is it out already?
No, it's out now. It is out. But but even before that, back, you know, in the DVD era, you know, they put out Armageddon and The Rock,
stuff.
Dead Presidents. So, you know, it's I think maybe, but you know, the fact that WALL-E is fairly recent, so I think that could be a hopeful sign. But and it would just be lovely if they could bring out the Straight Story. I mean, I have it on DVD, but I would like something a little higher resolution.
So we can move on here, but I do want to, you know, we're not talking about everything, but he did, as far as I remember, because I know I had the CD. For Danny Boyle's The Beach, he did one song with Orbital. Is that right?
I think that's right. You know, he has done collaborations with the various pop musicians, and I know like he and David Lynch did an album together with Julie Cruz. In the 90s, shortly before The Straight Story, Badalamenti co-wrote and produced an entire album with Marianne Faithfull.
Oh,
which is cool. It's pretty cool. I mean, that was the thing.
I wouldn't have known who that was at that time, but yeah.
Oh yeah, and when she had just been coming off of a couple of collaborations with Hal Wilner, who is you know, one of my favorite record producers actually. So you know, she can pick him. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, nothing that she did in the 90s really caught on with record buyers, which is kind of a shame. That was the thing. She, you know, she kind of hit a peak in 79 with Broken English. And then because everybody just went crazy about that record, and rightfully so, it's a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. But yeah, then after that, it's like, you know, she was just trying to get into some kind of groove, and it just didn't happen. But because she is who she is, it's like, you know, people are going to show up for her.
I remember in the early 2000s, was the album called Sliding Through Life on Charm, or was that just the song from it? But it was
I think that was the name of it. That was with John Bryan.
Okay, yeah, but also like she did a Beck song, Billy Corgan like wrote a song for her, like all these like people who would come along after her, you know.
Yeah, Jarvis Cocker wrote a song with her.
Right.
Blur did a song with her. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Cuz you know, everybody loves her.
Yeah. I was just, you know, scrolling through the filmography on IMDb, just seeing The Beach and remembering that, listening to that CD, because The Beach and just Danny Boyle is often very much more about like needle drops and you know, like using songs as opposed to score, and that's mostly what The Beach is, but there's still one in there. All right, so now we're on to the penultimate of your five, which I definitely have seen in a theater multiple times, and have on Blu-ray, Criterion Blu-ray. It's once again, David Lynch, Mulholland Drive. Should we hear that bit of music right now?
Oh, sure. And that's another really good mood setter, because that is the music over the main titles, where, you know, we just, again, you don't know what's going to happen. And then after it's happened, you still don't necessarily know what's happened in that movie. But that's, oh man, I remember because when it came out and I saw it, and it was the strangest thing that year, 2001, there were two movies I saw in theaters where at the end, the credits started to roll and some guy behind me said something along the lines of, "What the hell was that all about?" Mulholland Drive was one, and the other one was AI. Huh. So people just just people not into some things that year, I guess.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Yeah. I mean, I've seen the movie like a zillion times since then, and I love all the theories that people have about, you know, what it's about and what this is and what that is and all that kind of stuff. I love, you know, reading about them. But also, one of the things ultimately that I just do out of habit with David Lynch movies is that I don't try to put anything together. David Lynch movies, I just kind of sit there and let them happen at me.
Yeah, I think I learned that lesson very early on watching Lost Highway in my friend's bedroom when I was in high school on VHS. And at a certain point, just going like, I'm just going to have to like give up and just watch this.
And I've read theories about that one too, but who knows? That's the thing. It's like David Lynch and Bob Dylan are just, they're two guys that it's not going to do you any good to ask them questions, and whatever it is they want you to know about them, it's going to be in their work, and that's that. And you can take that work, or you can just try and figure out something on your own, but you're not getting anywhere with those guys. That's one of the things that I love about them.
I think David Lynch's quote is, you make a movie and then people want you to talk about it. The movie is the talking, is what I remember him saying. Yeah. We skipped over Lost Highway, but that's another one that I owned the soundtrack and listened to a lot in my teen years. Mulholland Drive, I saw at a theater. I believe I saw it at a theater in Chicago called the Three Penny. It cost more than three pennies to see movies there, but I saw it with Tyler, and we had quite different reactions to it. I mean, Tyler also loves Mulholland Drive, but I think he didn't know what to make of it at the time. And I, maybe because I'd already had that epiphany watching Lost Highway, I was like not trying to make anything of it. I specifically remember riding the train back home to our apartment with Tyler, and being like, I feel like I took some kind of drug, and him being like, yeah, good for you. he didn't hate it, there's another number of movies that, like, when we lived together that I took Tyler to that he didn't know what to make of at the time and now loves. The number one example is the Werkmeister Harmonies, the Béliard movie, which I dragged him to see with me, and he was like completely baffled by it, but couldn't get it out of his head, and has since like bought the DVD and watched it multiple times, and he loves that movie. But Mulholland Drive.
I'm curious about something else, because you aren't from here, right? And you were in the Midwest, and then eventually you came here. Does your perception of Mulholland Drive, do you look at it any differently now that you perceive anything differently, or is it there's stuff that you recognize in the movie, you know, that you of course you had no idea what it was before you came here? You know, does living here in Los Angeles affect your perception of Mulholland Drive in any way?
I think that's probably true of almost every movie that's set in Los Angeles, because I've lived in Los Angeles. I think if it hasn't happened now, it will happen before the end of 2023. I will have lived in Los Angeles longer than I ever lived in St. Louis. So now I think of myself as an Angeleno. yeah, lots of movies that I saw before, I think differently of now, or even movies that I saw after I moved here. You know, I know some people get, some listeners get annoyed at my like hangups about geography, you know. Yeah, just like at the end of Knocked Up, like, we know where his apartment is. Why is he driving north on the PCH? It's just so that you can have the shot with the ocean in it, I guess. But like, it doesn't make any sense
from
he should be going.
That stuff only we're gonna know, though. That's the thing.
Yeah. But it happens in like, because I lived in Chicago too, in My Best Friend's Wedding, another movie that I love. When Cameron Diaz picks Julia Roberts up at the airport, we see them driving down Lakeshore Drive, and they're going the wrong way based on what we know of like where O'Hare is and where they live. They're going the wrong way.
Based on what you know, I have no idea. I've never been there before. Yeah, that's
go ahead. Yeah,
it's weird. It's having, you know, lived here for, you know, pretty much my whole life, and then, you know, you see how you see stuff in movies, and you can say, oh well, I know where that is, and I've been in there, and so forth. But the one weird phenomenon that has plagued me for a long time is when it goes one of two ways. Either I'll be just going someplace and I'll see some location shooting and I'll say, oh, I wonder what that's going to be. And then I never see the finished product.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The flip side of that is that I'll see something in the movies or on TV and I'll be like, that's right around the corner from me. How did I not know this was happening? Son of a bitch. Cause there was that movie with Dwayne Johnson. I think it was called Faster. I don't know if you ever saw that one, but in the opening scene, he gets out of prison, he gets in a, you know, it's a sports car, and he drives someplace, and then he walks across the street and goes into a building and he kills somebody. Well, that street, it's right down here. It's Devonshire. You know, yeah. I know where that is, but there's only been one time when I stumbled across a film set and then I saw the movie, and it's for Licorice Pizza. Because that's another one. They filmed just over here. They're like a couple of blocks away from where I live. They just took a stretch of about a block and a half of Devonshire, and they just sort of set dressed it to look like the 1970s. And it was like in the middle of the first year of the pandemic. So I was working from home. And so, you know, I just went out to get some tacos or something. And I saw this and I thought, and I had a hunch that that's what it was. Because I remember reading that Paul Thomas Anderson was going to make a movie that was set in the 1970s in the San Fernando Valley. And I'm looking at the set dressing and I think, yeah, maybe this is it. And then later on, I saw the movie and it's like, finally, I saw a movie being made. And then I saw the movie. That's never happened to me before my whole damn life.
It didn't happen to me, but it happened to Natalie and my old, we lived in North Hollywood. And yeah, during the pandemic, she was out on one of her morning walks and she walked by the El Portal Theater at is that Lancashire?
Just Lancashire. North Magnolia,
right by the federal and she saw like, you know, film crew and stuff, and she saw they had changed the marquee to say On Her Majesty's Secret Service and The Mechanic. Do I have the wrong Bond movie? What would have been 72 or 73?
73 would have been Live and Let Die.
Oh, maybe it's Live and Let Die and The Mechanic. Anyway, it's a Bond movie and it's The Mechanic, and that's what's on the marquee at El Portal. And she like took a picture. She came home and she showed me, and she was like, I think I walked by the new PTA movie. They like had it looking like the 1970s. And I was like, oh, cool. And then, so we finally go to see the movie and like, we're loving the movie, but secretly we're sitting there waiting. Like, when are we going to see the El Portal? And it goes on and it goes on and on. And I'm thinking like, either like, maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe that was a different set that Natalie walked by that also happened to be a set in the early 70s, or maybe the scene got cut. And then lo and behold, it's the very end of the movie when they run down the sidewalk and embrace each other under the marquee. That was great. That's so close to my old apartment. Now, I don't know. I don't live near anything interesting enough for people to shoot right now, I don't think. But they used to, I mean, when I lived in North Hollywood, the North Hollywood Park, they used to shoot stuff there all the time, usually TV shows. I'd see, the Lucifer TV show would be there. There was a a show, I can't remember what network it was on, called All American. It was a TV show from a few years ago. It might still be on. It's basically kind of like, it's a show about a like poor black kid from South LA who's really good at football and gets sort of like, gets to like, goes to high school in Beverly Hills because someone like takes him under the wing because they want him to play for, maybe it was Pacific Palisades, whatever, some like rich LA neighborhood. He goes to play. Anyway, I never really watched the show, but they used to shoot in North Hollywood all the time. Miley Cyrus shot her, I guess it would have been the pandemic Grammys, when they were like, it was like virtual and there were a bunch of performances that were all shot like at different places, and Miley Cyrus shot one that was just her like suspended in a dark warehouse. That was one of the warehouses right along Chandler, just north of North Hollywood Park. Anyway, stuff used to shoot there all the time.
I haven't seen any of those things.
One time I came up the North Hollywood station. I came up the from the subway and they had all of these posters of Tony Goldwyn all over the place. It turned out they were shooting a flashback for Scandal. It was like a flashback to his original, like his like presidential campaign. And it was supposed to be like campaign stuff. But then one time I was watching Modern Family and they had a whole scene at the North Hollywood station. And I was like, you were saying, I was like, how did I miss that? Yeah. Modern Family was around the corner from me. Anyway, we've gotten so far off track.
One last thing before we move off Mulholland Drive, that movie also features an appearance by Angelo Badalamenti. He's in the movie very briefly. So that's, Remember he plays, Mr. Castigliani, the guy who didn't like the espresso.
Okay. Yeah.
That's him.
All right. Yeah. you reminded me of how we originally got into the question of that you were asking me about seeing movies. One thing I've reflected on is that the picture of Los Angeles that the movies give is not, I mean, if you happen to live in along Melrose or in Beverly Hills or at the beach, like Venice, you know, that's a lot of what you see, you know? Yeah. And that's not the day-to-day experience. So it's interesting to have moved here and then thought back and be like, oh, so what movies actually look like Los Angeles looks like? And definitely from my formative years, Jackie Brown and The Limey are both like LA movies that like, look like LA. Definitely I think Boys in the Hood looks more Los Angeles than something like Pretty Woman, you know? Yeah.
If you want to go further back, Model Shop, the Jacques Demy film, really does remind me of what LA looked like when I was a kid. I mean, I was like a little kid. The movie that was 69, I was born like a couple of years before that. But I mean, if you could move like forward like 3-4 years into the 70s, and LA still pretty much looked like Model Shop.
Did you ever see, I think it's like late 60s, early 70s, it's like a schlocky B-horror movie called The Witch That Came from the Sea.
No,
it's not actually about a witch. It's about a disturbed young woman who seduces and murders men. But it
also come from the sea.
She spends a lot of time staring out at the sea. There's a whole backstory about how her father drowned something. But anyway, it's set in the late 60s in Santa Monica. At a time like Santa Monica now, I think of as being very Tony and very expensive. Oh, yeah. But this is like late 60s, like kind of like grimy seaside bar, like Santa Monica. That's a fantastic, it's actually a really good movie, but it's also just a fantastic portrait of a Santa Monica that doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah. They, you know, for a number of years, it was just kind of run down and sort of a little generic. And after things over in Westwood Village went to hell, then all of a sudden everybody started moving over to Santa Monica and things really just kind of picked up there. And then Westwood turned into a ghost town and suddenly Santa Monica was the hip and happening place to be. If you see Pee-wee's Big Adventure, that gives you an idea of what the Third Street Promenade used to look like. Because the scene where the bicycle shop is, that whole section of the film that was shot on the Third Street Promenade, and it doesn't look anything like that now. Now it's just like really very busy, but back then it was just kind of like a run. It almost had like a small town vibe.
All right, well, let's get back to Battlementi, but not back to Lynch. We're ending the list. With a non-Lynch movie, Stephen Schoenberg's 2002 film Secretary. Let's real quick hear that.
I've never been sure what to make of this movie. I know ultimately it is really sort of in its own way about acceptance, which is something that, you know, I think we should all have a little more. We could all use a little more of that in our lives now more than ever. But it's always kind of strange to see a story about something that you agree with, but put in a way that you might not have put it yourself had you had the opportunity to tell that story, to make that point. It is a movie that, you know, it does fascinate me. Maggie Gyllenhaal is just, I think that was the first time that I saw her in anything that I can recall. And I thought she was just astounding. And, you know, I just, you know, kept an eye on her ever since. James Spader is really good. Now he's on that TV show that I stopped watching.
Blacklist. Is that still on?
It is. I think they're on their last season now. I don't know, but I would like, okay. I started watching it just cause he was on it. And, but after a couple of seasons, I was like, well, this isn't changed. There's nothing going on here that's going to be any different. It was like, you know, so I just decided to walk away.
Yeah. 10th and final season it's on.
Yeah. There you
go. Yeah. I guess let's talk about the song that you picked really quick. Cause it's a move back, not quite all the way in the direction of the Pink Room from Firewalk with Me, but this is another sort of, bluesy guitar and drums song.
Yeah. But it's got a sort of a weird kind of a vibe to it. In a way, a little bit here and there, there's touches of it that remind me of Brian Eno for some reason. But it's got a very odd mood to it. And this is the music that basically plays over the end credits. So this is where they're sending you home. They're sending you home on this vibe, which is, you know, it's a good kind of summation of where we are emotionally at the end of this story. You know, it's like, though, this is what it is. You can deal with it or you can take a walk.
I'm very fond of of that movie. And it's been a long time though since I've seen it. I didn't realize that that's what this song was. Because yeah, it does end in a way that I find refreshingly like uncompromising, or but not like in a bold way. I guess the word I'm looking for is what you said. It's just acceptance.
Yeah.
I watched this movie probably on DVD in Chicago because my girlfriend at the time loved it and was like, "Oh, you haven't seen this?" It would have only been 2 or 3 years old at this point. She was like, "You didn't see Secretary?" And I watched it with her, and that's when I was reminded, "Oh yeah, women love James Spader." I don't know. Maybe the Blacklist has taken some of the shine off of James Spader, but yeah, people think he's very sexy, and I don't blame him. But yeah, as far as Maggie Gyllenhaal, she would have been in Donnie Darko before this, right?
Oh Donnie yeah, Darko. That's right. But I didn't see that movie when it came out. It was one of those things that, because of the cult reputation that it acquired, I saw it sort of somewhere further down the road. And then I tried to see that guy's next movie.
And Southland Tales?
Yeah. I couldn't get through that.
I watched it for the first time during the pandemic, like during the quarantine. I'm glad I watched it. I can't get on board with the people who love it, but I'm glad it exists. It seems like such a portrait of its era, the sort of like reality TV and the Iraq War, like just all like that at the same time. It's a really interesting movie, definitely. But yeah, so that's where we're ending. That's not the last movie that Angelo Badalamenti did. He worked with Paul Schrader for Autofocus. He did the music for Eli Roth's Cabin Fever, which I don't can't say that I remember that well. I remember thinking the movie's okay.
Yeah, he did like three or four movies with Paul Schrader, as a matter of fact.
Well, as I was going to say, actually, he did Dominion, the prequel to The Exorcist, and only that. When they took that movie away from Paul Schrader and largely reshot it with is Rennie Harlan, is that who?
Yeah, Rennie Harlan.
Yeah, and renamed it The Exorcist: The Beginning. They also took away his music. Trevor Rabin. I just had to look it up. Trevor Rabin did the music for Exorcist: The Beginning, which I never saw. I only ever saw the Paul Schrader movie when it came out on DVD. I don't think it never got released theatrically. It came out later,
right.
On DVD with some very unfortunately low budget CGI. Because I guess whatever studio has The Exorcist, is that Fox?
Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers. They weren't going to pay for the CGI that the movie was probably required. But I thought Dominion was good. Let's see. He worked with Jean-Pierre Jeunet on A Very Long Engagement. He had also done
The City of Lost Children.
Children. Yeah. I mentioned before. I think with Nightmare on Elm Street that he can be creepy and he seems suited to horror. He's all these movies that I watched, but I don't specifically remember the music to, like Cabin Fever. Also, Walter Says' Dark Water, which I remember being a much better mid-aughts horror flick than people give it credit for, with Jennifer Connelly and John C. Reilly. He did that music. I can't say I remember it, but definitely seems fitted to him. Oh, I did see 44 Inch Chest, which is kind of a stodgy movie. I do actually kind of remember his a kind of drony music in that. So yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm just scrolling through. Okay, I was trying to see if there's anything else major. I'm glad we got to do this. I'm glad we got to pay some respects to Angelo Badalamenti, since he won't be the subject of our next profile. I guess stay tuned, or just check out my letterbox and you'll probably find out who our next profile is. Do you have any more thoughts on Angelo Badalamenti? Any more recommendations outside of the world of film scores? I know you mentioned some other projects he's done. Anything else come to mind?
No, just like, again, I mentioned like the stuff that he did with Lynch and Julie Cruz. He also did a sort of a kind of dark techno jazz avant-garde type album with David Lynch under the name Thought Gang, which is pretty weird. David Lynch's forays into music are, I mean, unexpected, but welcome.
Yeah.
But he's they've done some really interesting stuff together. But overall, just you can see through that through his filmography that he's good with, you know, we've seen he's good with sort of more, you know, orchestral elements, but you know, he can do stuff with synthesizers, he can do like pop oriented stuff, he can do sort of the, like electronic oriented stuff, he can do a lot of like kind of jazz stuff too. You know, he has a pretty firm solid background in jazz music as well, so
yeah. I'm trying to remember that. I know there's a lot of jazz type stuff in Lost Highway. Is that his? That's his. Yeah. Okay. Cause I know there's also, at least one like Barry Adamson song on that soundtrack, that I really like, but I didn't know if the jazz is also Angelo Badalamenti. Good.
Yeah. He was just a fairly versatile guy, you know, just and an all around fine composer. You know, it's a shame that, that he's gone.
Well, thanks. You can find us at battleshipretention.com. You can, like I mentioned, Tyler's GoFundMe. You can follow me on Twitter at Davey Pretension. Email me at david@battleshipretention.com. Check out my other podcast that I do with my wife. It's called The One Where I Met Your Mother. We watch an episode of Friends and an episode of How I Met Your Mother every week. And that one's a lot of fun. We're almost through season four. So, which means we recently finally heard Joey say his, like, how you doing, which I never watched the show before, and I kept marveling, like, man, we're three seasons into the show, I know this is his catchphrase and I haven't heard it, but by the end of season four he finally starts saying how you doing. So I don't know, check out the show and listen to me and Natalie talk about that. West, where would you like people to find you?
If you have to find me anywhere, I am definitely on Twitter and Instagram as Dr. West Anthony. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here and for once again gracing us with your presence as our resident musicologist.
Thank you for having me. It's always great to be here.
And thank you at home for listening. And we'll get you next time. Bye.